One. He was a big fellow, looking seriously pale in the streets of Harlem in deep summer. I am small and not so dark, not very threatening to Caucasians. I do not strut my stuff. We shook hands. My inability to recall that particular moment more precisely is disappointing. The handshake is the threshold act, the beginning of politics. I've seen him do it 2 million times now, but I couldn't tell you how he does it, the right-handed part of it, the strength, the quality, duration of it, the rudiments of pressing the flesh. I can, however, tell you a whole lot about what he does with his other hand. He is a genius with it. He might put it up on your elbow or up by your biceps. These are basic, reflexive moves. He is interested in you. He is honored to meet you. If he gets any higher up on your shoulder, if he, say, drapes his left arm over your back, it is somehow less intimate, more casual. He'll share a laugh or a secret then, a light secret, not a real one, flattering you with the illusion of conspiracy. If he doesn't know you all that well, and you've just told him something important, something earnest or emotional, he will lock in and honor you with a two-hander, his left hand overwhelming your wrist and forearm. He'll flash that famous misty look of his, and he will mean it. Anyway, as I recall, he gave me a left hand just above the elbow, plus a vaguely curious, "Ah, so you're the guy I've been hearing about," look, and a follow me nod. I didn't have the time or presence of mind to send any message back at him. Slow emotional reflexes, I guess. His were lightning. He was 6 meaningful handshakes down the row before I caught up, and then I fell in, a step or two behind, classic staff position, as if I'd been doing it all my life. I had, but not for anyone so good. We were sweeping up into the library, the librarian in tow, and now he had his big ears on. She was explaining her program and he was in heavy listening mode, the most aggressive listening the world has ever known. Aerobic listening. It is an intense, disconcerting phenomenon. As if he were hearing quicker than you can get the words out, as if he were sucking the information out of you. When he gives full ear, a rare enough event, he's usually ingesting from 2 or 3 sources, his listening becomes the central fact of the conversation. He was doing this now, with a librarian, and she was staggering under it. She missed a step, he reached out, steadied her. She was middle-aged, pushing 50, hair dyed auburn to blot the gray, unexceptional except for her legs, which were shocking, a gift from God. Had he noticed the legs when she almost went down on the stair? I couldn't tell. Howard Ferguson III had insinuated himself next to me. As we nudged up the crowded staircase, his hand squeezing my elbow, "Lord, these were touchy fellas," saying, "Glad you changed your mind. Jack's really excited you could do this." "What are we doing?" I asked. Howard had called and invited me to meet Governor Jack Stanton, who might or might not be running for president. The governor was stopping in New York on his way to do some early explanatory wandering through New Hampshire. The invitation came with an intriguing address. In Harlem, of all places. There was no money in Harlem, and this was the serious money-bagging stage of the campaign, especially for an obscure southern governor. It also came with shameless flattery. "You're legendary," Howard had said in a dusty Midwestern voice, cagey and playful. "He wants to lure you out of retirement." Retirement. I had fled Washington after 6 years with Congressman William Larkin. It had been my first job out of school, and I was a victim of his upward mobility from member to whip to majority leader, too much. I hadn't been ready for power. I'd kind of enjoyed the back benches. It was too soon for me to be someone. The majority leader's guy. The guy you had to get with if you wanted something in or out of this or that. And so, on my 30th birthday, an epiphany. "I'm sorry, sir. I need a break," I told the congressman. "Don't you believe in what we're doing?" he asked. "You mean counting heads? Let me out of here." I was going out with a woman named March then. She was great looking, but she worked for Nader and came equipped with a lack of irony guaranteed to survive the most rigorous crash testing. I found myself having fantasies of working my way through the months, April, May, June. I don't remember what I told her. I told her something.
Henry, isn't this a little young for a midlife crisis? She asked.
No. I called Philip Noyce at Columbia. I'd known him all my life. He was a colleague of Father's, back before Father left Mother and began his World's Most Obscure Universities tour. In the event, Philip gave me a gig. I taught legislative process. As midlife crises go, it had been a busman's holiday. Now I thought I might be ready to resume things. Anyway, I was curious. What was Jack Stanton doing up in Harlem when he should be down on Wall Street trying to impress the big spenders? Was he trying to impress me? I doubt it. More likely, he had invited me along for racial cover. I was, I realized, the only black face in his entourage. Howard Ferguson certainly was about as far as you could get from dark. I noticed the discreet bobble of perspiration moving diagonally down the side of his forehead into his weird Elvis sideburn, as if his sweat were rationed. He was so dry, so thin-lipped austere, and his eyes burned so hard, one imagined that whatever juice he had inside was precious. If he didn't stay lubricated, he might catch fire. Howard was legendary himself, sort of. Vestigial, a prairie ghost. He was born to a line of arsonists. His great-grandfather, Firefly Ferguson, had set the wheat fields ablaze and run for governor from a jail cell. Howard wore Firefly's parched, sandy face, thinning hair parted in the middle, and a pink-flowered liberty tie. "I do not take this life, these lawyer clothes, seriously," it said. His role in the Stanton operation was elusive. Months later, I'd still be trying to figure it out. He was a man who never tipped his hand, who never expressed an opinion in a meeting, and yet gave off the sense that he had very powerful convictions, too powerful to be hinted among strangers. He had known the governor forever, since the anti-war days.
"Have you ever been to an adult literacy program?" he asked, then chuckled. "Jack eats this shit up. Says it's like going to church."
So it was. It was a better room than the usual government issue formica and cinderblock. There were none of the relentless cheery posters of books and owls. It was a dark, solemn place, a WPA library. The bookcases were oak and went most of the way up the walls. There was a mural above, a Bentonian popular front vision of biplanes buzzing the Statue of Liberty, locomotives rushing through wheat fields, glorious muscular laborers going to work, a Howard Ferguson dreamscape. They didn't need hortatory read-books propaganda back then. There were other struggles. The class was seated around a large, round oak table. They were what the WPA muralist had in mind, a saintly proletariat. The librarian condescending to them in the reflexive, unconsciously insulting manner of public servants everywhere, introduced the visitor.
"Governor Jack Stanton, who has been a great friend of continuing education, is now running for..."
She tossed a flirtatious look his way.
"Cover," he said.
"Do you want to say a few..."
"No, no. Y'all go on ahead," he purred. "Don't mind me."
He took a seat away from the table, deftly respecting the integrity of the class. I sat diagonally across the room from him. I could watch him watching them. Howard stood behind me, leaning against a bookcase. They introduced themselves. They were waitresses, dishwashers, and janitors, most in their 20s and 30s, people with night jobs. Each read a little. The woman had an easier time of it than the men, who really struggled. And then they said something about their lives. It was very moving. The last to go was Dwayne Smith, who weighed 300 pounds easy and was a short-order chef.
"They just kept passing me up, you know," he said. "Couldn't read a lick, had a learning disability."
He looked over to the librarian to make sure he had said it right.
"Dwayne's dyslexic," she said.
"They just kept passing me up, third grade, fourth grade, and I'm like too proud, you know? It was like no one noticed anyways. I sit in the back, I ain't a Mally brother, a person. Don't cause no trouble, I stick to myself. So I go on through, all the ways through. I graduate elementary school, They sent me to Ben Franklin, General Studies. They could have sent me to the Bronx Zoo. No one ever told me nothing. No one ever say, Dwayne, you can't read. What are you going to do with your sorry ass? Excuse me.
He looked over at the governor, who smiled, urging him on.
This was 20 years ago, the librarian interjected. We're better at catching those things now.
As if that canceled out such monumental callousness, the numb stupidity of the system.
Anyway, graduation come. My mama come. She take the day off from the laundry where she work, puts on a church dress. She don't have a clue nothing's wrong. Me neither. I've been skating through. So we're there, and Dr. Dalimberti, he's calling out the names and what we did, like Sharona Harris, honors, or Tyrone Kirby, Regents Diploma. And everyone's gotta just stand there on stage while they come up one by one. So they get to my name, going alphabetical, you know? And Dr. Dalimberti says, so everyone hear it, Dwayne Smith received a certificate of attendance. You can hear people buzzing, a couple of folks laughing a little, and I gotta walk up there and get this. It looked just like a diploma, you know? Some kind of paper. Funny how I'm thinking people won't notice because it's the same kind of paper, but it don't work. Everyone know the truth now. And I'm thinking, sucker. These folks expect you a fool. They got rid of everyone else can't read. They drop out. And my reward for sticking around is I gotta stand there burning. And I'm trying not to look at anyone. Trying not to look too stupid, you know? But feeling stupid as a rock. A girl come up after me giggling a little, still laughing about me, you know? She nervous because she got to stand next to the idiot, like it's catching or something. And I see my mama out there with her hat on and a purse in her lap. She wearing her white church gloves. She got her glasses on and tears coming down from behind her glasses, like someone hurt her bad, like someone died. I kind of lost it then. I tried to gulp down the sob. But Dwayne had caught me somewhere deeper and earlier than politics. Damn. I shuddered. Tears leaked out the side of my eye. And do you know how it happens at a moment like that, when you are embarrassed like that, you will look directly, reflexively, at the very person you don't want to see you? I looked over at Jack Stanton. His face was beet red, his blue eyes glistening, and tears were rolling down his cheeks. The first thought was relief. Relief and amazement and a sudden, sharp, quite surprising, affinity. This was followed quickly by a caveat. Weakness? Ed Muskie in the snow in New Hampshire? But that evaporated because Stanton had launched himself into motion, rubbing his cheeks off with the back of his hands. Everyone knew now that he had lost it, standing up, standing over the table, hands on the shoulders of two of the students, leaning over the table toward Dwayne and saying, I am so very, very deeply grateful that you'd share that with us, Dwayne. It wasn't nearly so bad as the words sound now. He had the courage of his emotions. And I think it is time we made it impossible. I mean impossible for anyone to get lost in the system like you did. We had to learn to cherish our young people. But most of all, I want to thank you for believing, for having faith. Faith that you can overcome the odds and learn and succeed. It was getting a little thick, and he seemed to sense it. He got off the soapbox, kicked back, circled the table, over to where Dwayne was. I had him in profile now. Take some courage, too. How many of y'all tell your friends and family where you're going when you come here? There were smiles. Let me tell you a story, he said. It's about my Uncle Charlie. This happened just before I was born, so I only got it from my mama, but I know it's true. Charlie came home from the war a hero. He'd been on Iwo Jima, you know, where they raised the flag. And he had taken out several machine gun nests of Japanese soldiers, who had a whole squad of his buddies pinned down. First one with a grenade, second one by himself with a rifle and a bayonet and bare hands. They found him with a knife in his gut and his hands around an enemy soldier's throat. He had 2 bullets in him, too. Dwayne said, shit. Yeah, that's right, Stanton said, moving clockwise around the table now, like a big cat. They gave him the Medal of Honor. President Truman did. And then he came home to our little town, Grace Junction. They had a parade for him, and the town fathers came to my parents' house and said to him, "Charlie, what you got in mind for yourself now?" Charlie said he didn't know. Well, they offered him money in the bank and cattle out west, if you know what I mean. Anything he wanted. The mayor said Charlie could have a full scholarship to the state university. The banker said he could understand if Charlie didn't want to go back to school after all he'd been through, so he was offering him a management job, big future, at the bank. The sawmill owner, we're from Piney Woods country, says, "Charlie, you may not want to be cooped up in a bank. Come manage my crew." And you know what? Damned if Charlie didn't turn them all down. Stanton stopped. He waited. One of the women said,
"So what'd he do?"
"Nothing. He just lay down on the couch, smoked his luckies, let himself go. No one could get him off that couch."
"Oh, I got it,"
said a wiry Hispanic with a pencil-thin mustache.
"He got his head mess up. He got one of them post-dramatic things, right?"
"Nope," Stanton said very calmly. "It was just that, well, he couldn't read." Head snapped. Someone said, "What?" Someone whistled. Someone said, "No shit." He couldn't read, and he was embarrassed. He didn't want to tell anyone, Stanton said. He had the courage to win the Congressional Medal of Honor, but he didn't have the strength to do what each of you has done, what each of you is doing right here. He didn't have the courage to admit he needed help and to find it. So I want you to know that I understand. I appreciate what you are doing here. I honor your commitment. And when people ask me, "Jack Stanton, why are you always spending so much money and so much time and so much effort on adult literacy programs?" I tell them, "Because it gives me a chance to see real courage. It inspires me to be stronger. I am so grateful you've let me visit with you today." I have seen better speakers and heard better speeches, but I don't think I have ever heard, at least not till that moment, a speaker who measured his audience so well and connected so precisely. It was an impressive bit of politics, and they were all over him then, clapping his back, shaking his hand, hugging him. He didn't back off, keep his space the way most Pauls would. He leaned into them and seemed to get as much satisfaction from touching them, draping his big arm over their shoulders, as they got from him. He had this beatific, slightly goofy look on, and then Duane said, "Wait a minute." The room fell silent. "What about Charlie?"
"Well, it took a while," Stanton said more conversationally. They were all friends now. "He started hanging around the high school when I got up there. Stanton was embarrassed. He was making a decision. He went ahead with it. "Well, I was the manager of the varsity baseball team, and Charlie liked to sit with me on the bench helping out, and that grew into helping out around the gymnasium, and finally they offered him a job when Mr. Krause died."
"Who Mr. Krause? What job he got?"
"Oh, he was the school janitor."
"No shit?"
He stayed with them for a time, answering questions, signing autographs. The library lady pitched Stanton about the need for more money. There was a long waiting list of people who wanted to get into that program, but had to be turned away. Then they all followed him back downstairs, out to the car. Howard Ferguson and I trailed the crowd. Howard squeezed my arm gently, just above the elbow, kind of chuckled, a strangled guffaw, and shrugged, as if to say, "What can I say?"
"How do you know him?"
I asked, having to ask something.
"Oh, a long time," he said.
The governor was down on the sidewalk now, chugging through another round of meaningful handshakes. Ferguson and I stood over by the car.
"So, what do you think?" Howard asked.
I said something enthusiastic, but I really was wondering, is he expecting me to say something like,
"Where do I sign up?"
Didn't they want to sit down and say, "Here's what we're doing, and here's what we'd like you to do, and what do you think about this issue or that person, and how do you think someone should run for president of the United States these days?" Stanton came over, looked at me.
"So?"
"Well, that was something," I said.
"I can't believe we can't rustle up enough dough to make this available to anyone who wants it," he said.
What was this going to be? A policy discussion?
Why didn't you guys fund it better?
Because my former boss was a weenie. But do you just say that straight off?
If you badmouth the old boss, what does that tell the prospective new boss about your loyalty?
Well, it was late. We got trapped in a formula fight, I said, and gobbledygooked on about rules and amendments and assorted horseshit. But he didn't listen very long. In fact, he turned away halfway through a sentence. No pretense about just shutting me down. And asked Ferguson, where?
Times editorial board, Howard said laconically. You're only about a half an hour late right now.
Stanton suddenly was red in the face. I mean, the mood had changed with blinding speed from sunshine to tornado in a blink.
You call them?
He demanded, eyes squinting down. If the answer was no, I was afraid Stanton would deck him.
Of course, Howard said. Told them traffic.
Stanton lightened as suddenly as he darkened. Clouds scudding on a windy day.
I love New York, he said, back to, aw shucks, I'm just a poor country governor. Easiest place in the world to be late. We'd better roll.
Stanton ducked into the car. Was that it? Weren't they forgetting something? Howard cracked his window.
Can you meet us in our suite up at the Regency about 11 tonight?
11?
Stanton rolled down his window. What's the matter, Henry?
He asked, slyly, conspiratorially.
You got some action going?
No, I said.
Boy, did I feel slow.
Was he looking for something clever, something sexual? He kept coming at me from places I didn't expect.
See you then, Ferguson said as the car rolled away.
11 o'clock? Well, it was late. It implied that we were skipping ahead past the usual formalities. It assumed an intimacy that did not exist, in my mind yet. But it was flattering, too. It also assumed I was a professional and would understand the rhythms of a campaign, even a larval one. Politicians work, they do their public work, that is, when civilians don't. Mealtimes, evenings, weekends. The rest of the time, downtime, is spent indoors in hotel suites, worrying the phones, dialing for dollars, fighting over the next moves, living outside time. There are no weekdays or weekends. There is sleep, but not much rest. Sometimes, and always at the oddest hours, you may break free. An afternoon movie, a midnight dinner. And there are those other fleeting moments when your mind drifts from him, from the podium, and you fix on the father and son tossing a ball out past the back of the crowd, out in the park. And you suddenly realize, hey, it's Saturday. Or you glance out a hotel window and spot an elderly couple walking hand in hand, still alive in each other's mind, as opposed to merely sharing space, waiting it out. The campaign, with all its talk of destiny, crisis, and mission, falls away, and you remember. Other people just have lives. Their normality can seem a reproach. It hurts your eyes, like walking out of a matinee into bright sunlight. Then it passes. He screws up a line. It's Q&A time. It's time to move. The suite at the Regency brought all that back. It was generic. It existed outside time. I was at once vaguely depressed and entirely comfortable. There was a handful of Pauls in shirt sleeves, working the phones, hammering laptops, nibbling off platters of fruit and cheese, chugging Diet Cokes. No smoke, no booze anymore, but a haze of ill health all the same. Sycophancy frays the nerves, clogs the arteries. I didn't know most of them. There were a couple of bodyguard trooper types. There were a couple of handy wipes with wispy mustaches, statehouse sorts about to be paved over. And there was Arlen Sporkin, a Washington media consultant I knew only by reputation, which was mixed. He was hot right then, as hot as he would ever be, having just won a special election down in the Carolinas with a pro-choice ad that sold the crackers on the notion that the Founding Fathers fought and died for the right to a DNC. Sporkin had a great, fresh effusion of golden farm boy hair, after which it was all downhill, his body dissolving into a shocking wallow of fat. Pauls tend to be fat, except for the joggers and jigglers,
who burned down like fuses in a campaign. Sporkin had a kind face, a pleasant drawl. He was from Mississippi and reeked of the unironic liberal fervor common to Southern Baptists who'd had conversion experiences during the Civil Rights years. He was a booster, an enthusiast, and another toucher, a flagrant one. "Henry Burton, as I live and breathe," he announced, yanking my hand, then crushing me in a full body hug that culminated in actual backslapping and rib chucking. "So you're on board?"
"Well, I..."
"He thinks you're great. Great. Just great." This was more than your standard white boy overcompensation in overdrive. "We're gonna win this thing," he was saying now. "Don't you think?"
Since this couldn't possibly be the beginning of a serious conversation about the campaign, I said something harmless like, "Well, who else is in?"
"Henry, you really have been away. Harris, definitely. Martin, maybe. Luther Charles, well, you know Brother Charles."
I did know Luther, mostly as a distant childhood memory. I hadn't seen him in years, but Sporkin couldn't possibly have known that. He was assuming that since Luther was a brother, I'd have tribal vibes about his political intentions. So I sent him a quasi-disdainful look that said, "We don't share vibes on the first date with persons outside the pigment." Arlen, a good liberal, retreated, respecting my racial space.
"The big question is Ozzio, of course," he concluded. "You think he's got the cojones to run?"
A mortal dork, this guy. I considered the door, but I wanted to see Stanton again, I guess.
"Ozzio?
Don't know him personally," I said. It was one of those conversations you have, usually with civilians, where life imitates the McLaughlin group, where you say the safe, expected things. Political chat. But I strayed a little then, got too close to something real. "If Ozzio did go, and put it all together," I asked, "would you take the two spot?"
"Fuck a duck," said a familiar voice just behind me. "I'll take what I can get."
Stanton had cracked open the door to the bedroom behind him. He was buttoning his shirt over a hairless pink chest. He was the color of a medium-rare steak just off the grill, steaming a little.
I had heard about this. He opened the door wider.
"You remember Ms. Baum?" he said.
The librarian. I hope I didn't gasp. She was arranging herself. He seemed a bit dazed. She whacked her shoulder on the bedroom door, trying to squeeze past him.
"Oh,"
she yipped. He leaned into her, put his arm on her.
"You all right, darling?"
She stiffened, desperately attempting to maintain the appearance of propriety. He was, well, he was entirely unembarrassed, as if he'd just sneezed or scratched himself or yawned or done any of those semi-private physical things normal people are willing to do in front of strangers.
"Well, Governor," she said, "it was good to have this..."
He saved her, or tried to.
"Henry," he said, turning to me, "don't you think Miss Baum runs just a great program?"
I said something.
"Thanks so much," she said, moving toward the door, "for..."
"You're going to give my best to Irv Gelber, right?"
"Of course, we'll..."
"Take this up with your board. Tell Irv I'll even extend him the privilege of whooping my butt on the golf course."
He had moved toward the door, following her. He put his hand on her shoulder, stopping her. He whispered something in her ear. She inhaled, then darted out the door.
"Bye now,"
he said, closing the door, chuckling a little. He moved over toward the bar. There were piles of sandwiches, fruit and cheese. He prowled the food. He worried over it. He reached for a sandwich, restrained himself, chose an apple, a perfect red delicious, like the poisoned one in Snow White, and made it disappear.
"Ms. Baum is on the regional board of the teachers' union," he explained, still chewing.
"I was wondering why you chose that particular library," I said, "in Harlem." Arlen Sporkin was immediately in my face. "The governor always visits adult literacy programs wherever he goes." Stanton didn't seem too eager to acknowledge the politics of it either. That part was obvious. It wasn't something you had to talk about.
He made it clear, through the slightest of winces, a raised hand, a turn away, something, that this was an invasion of his innocence, a squall line threatening his uncloudy day.
Well, it was a pretty amazing experience, I tried.
What an idiot. And nobody said anything. Nobody helped me out.
Stanton peered at me in a kindly way, as if he hoped that I'd know where to take the conversation from there.
But I was stuck, clueless, and beginning to sweat.
And then, for the first of what would be many, many times, she saved me.
The phone.
The missus, a trooper said.
He snagged a sandwich on the way. The receiver seemed tiny in his hand. I noticed his long, graceful fingers. He caressed the phone. It was clear he knew how to work it.
Hi, darling, he said.
And then she leveled him. The sharp, distant bark was audible where I stood. His eyes narrowed, his furrow browed.
Oh, honey, listen, I know.
I'm sorry.
We got stuck here.
But great news. Real progress with the teachers. His eyes narrowed again.
Tonight? Are you sure?
I'm sorry, I had no idea. Then, to one of the statehouse guys,
Charlie, did you know we were supposed to meet the guy from the Portsmouth Democratic Committee tonight?
Charlie shrugged, smiled. He was a thin, taut little man, a jockey.
God damn it, Charlie.
He shrugged, smiled at Charlie, then back on the phone.
Tell him I'll come by first thing tomorrow.
No, Susan.
Please.
Come on.
No, I want to.
We'll get right up there. We'll leave now.
If you just quit popping my eardrums, we'd...
Okay, I'm...
No, please don't go.
Stay there. Stay right there, Susan.
He hung up, shrugged.
We better go, he said.
Where's the plane?
Teterboro,
one of the troopers said.
Shit. All the way out there. Come on, we gotta get out of here.
There was all sorts of movement now. Papers gathered up. The jockey was in the bedroom, then out, with a suitcase. Stanton snagged another apple. He put his arm around Sporkin.
You're doing what we talked about?
Putting it together, he said. But you know, Washington, they ain't coming along until you show what you can do.
Then they'll be panting after us like pigs in heat. But let them know we know that.
I hear you, Sporkin said. And Governor, I think you're doing just great. They're not gonna know what hit them.
See you in D.C., Stanton said.
You coming, Henry?
Coming?
Look, he said. We'll talk on the plane. Wait a minute. He dashed into the bedroom. He came out with a bunch of toiletries provided by the hotel. Shampoo, toothbrush, comb.
What else you need? He said.
I've got classes tomorrow, I said.
Calling sick. It's summer school, he said. Kids won't mind.
The jockey was standing next to him now, with a garment bag.
Oh, Henry, he said. This is my Uncle Charlie. You coming?
He was asleep as soon as we got on the plane. It was a noisy little prop job. Any conversation would have been strained, difficult. I tried with Uncle Charlie.
You're the Medal of Honor winner?
He say that?
I nodded.
Whatever he says, Charlie laughed. He's the master.
Are you related to his mom or dad?
His dad died.
I knew that.
Did you know him well?
Nobody knew him well enough.
It was very late. The plane tracked low over the northeast corridor, between a cottony layer of clouds and an electric map. Traces of light, towns and strip malls, country roads. It was like a toy, a model railroad. Not quite real. This was all very strange, to say the least. I closed my eyes. I must have slept. She was standing there, alone in the dark, on the tarmac at Manchester. It was a soft, heavy night, too cloudy for a moon, or perhaps too late. The terminal lights were dim, opalescent in the mist. There was a slight neon buzz. A minivan stood just beyond the chain-link fence, engine idling.
headlights rehearsing a smoky vaudeville of moths and mosquitoes. There was nothing else. We staggered down the stairs, him last.
"Susan Stanton," she said, shaking my hand.
"Henry Burton," I said.
"I know. I met you 25 years ago, at your grandfather's, in Oak Bluffs. You were running around in wet underpants. Just out of the sprinkler, I think. Very cute."
She rattled this off crisply, an ironic commentary on Susan Stantonhood. I was charmed. Then, without irony, "Your grandfather was a great man."
"Only if you didn't know him." But I just said, "Thank you."
"Jack Stanton could also be a great man," she said, without turning to her husband, "if he weren't such a faithless, thoughtless, disorganized, undisciplined shit." The governor was off to my side, back a little. I didn't want to look too hard, so I couldn't see the expression on his face. It was, undoubtedly, the furrowed brow, pouty-mouthed, elementary school, penitent look. He reached out an arm to her, which she swatted away with a file folder.
"First impressions, asshole," she said. "These people don't know you. They don't even know you by reputation. They have United States senators courting them. They are waiting to be swept off their feet by Orlando Ozio, who is the governor of a real state."
"They may be waiting a while for—"
"They don't know that," she snapped. "They don't know shit. The Democratic town leader of Portsmouth only knows that he is supposed to have an after-dinner drink with the governor of a state whose capital he learned in third grade and promptly forgot and never had cause to think about from that day to this. And you never showed." Oh, he was wowed by the missus. "Never met a woman so interested in fly fishing before. Jack, do you realize how incredibly, indescribably, skull-crushingly boring fly fishing is? Do you realize I've now committed to doing this, this thing with him? I will fly fish with him because of you, you asshole. You cannot do this to me. You can't. We've only been at this a month, and already you're fucking up in your old fucked up way. The only shot we have here is perfection. You cannot blow off the party leaders. I am not going to let you embarrass—"
I was aware then of a subtle softening in the air. It was eerie, vaguely narcotic. He was whistling. The song was on the tip of my tongue, from before my time. Syrupy, mainstream, late '50s pop.
"Jack," she said sharply. Then less so, "Jack, you asshole."
And now he was singing.
"Primrose Lane, life's a holiday on Primrose Lane. When I'm walking down that Primrose Lane with you."
He had a slight, reedy tenor voice with a touch of sandpaper to it. Not quite professional quality, but there was a musical intelligence behind it, a humility. He knew not to reach for too much. He toyed with his limitations. It was lovely and utterly insidious. It made her anger seem transparent, unsubtle, the stunt it was. He was saying, "I know your game, too." Susan turned and began walking toward the minivan. He came up behind her, put his arms around her, snuggling her neck, cupping her breasts. They stood there silently for a moment, swaying slightly to the song he was no longer singing.
"So Henry and I were at this great, great reading program in Harlem today," he was saying as we drove along, crowded together in the minivan. Stanton and the driver up front, me, Susan, Uncle Charlie in the middle, the trooper and a couple of boxes of groceries, mostly munchies, it appeared, in the back.
"You should have seen those people."
"Was it one of yours or one of mine?" Susan asked him.
"Well, let me think," he said. "The librarian was, well, she was kind of inspirational. It was—"
"Henry," she cut him off. "He'll never tell the truth. You settle it. Here's the deal. Stanton and I have this argument about social programs. He's a sucker for inspirational leaders. He figures you can parse genius, analyze it, break it down, and teach others how to do it. My feeling is, give me a break. Only God can make a tree. You can't teach inspiration. What you do is come up with a curriculum. Something simple, direct. Something you don't need Mother Teresa to make happen.
and that's what you replicate.
But you can't sell anything if the teacher is a dud, he said. You gotta figure out a way to make great teachers. If you can really liberate them, reward them for creativity, they'll make their own programs. Henry, you ever seen a curriculum inspire wonder? This is an argument I always win.
Henry, she interrupted, tell us about the librarian. Kind of inspirational, the governor said.
Well, she was...
They were, I knew, listening very closely now. It was showtime. She was a pretty typical library bureaucrat.
Ha! Susan Stanton snorted.
But it didn't matter. She didn't have to be very good because they wanted it so bad, I continued. Having allowed her the battle, I wasn't about to take sides in the war.
See, your argument is moot when the hunger is there. If everyone wanted to read or whatever, as much as those folks did today, social policy would be a walk in the park.
But you both know that's not where the problem is. It's creating the hunger for nutritious things when all they know is junk food.
And that's where inspiration comes in, Stanton said.
Watch out, she said. He's going to do his Lee Strasberg number on you now.
Tell me I'm wrong, he said. They should teach teachers, psychologists, social workers, all the people who do community stuff, like they teach actors. Make them aware of their bodies, how to project, how to emote.
We already have a nation of bad actors, she said.
Okay.
It was a set piece, and kind of goofy at that. But it was about policy, not politics, not tactics, not gossip. They cared about it. They went on, not like principals, but like staffers, or perhaps academics. Susan did teach law at the state university, when she wasn't helping her husband run the state.
They could cite case studies.
He had a good one. A professor at the University of Tennessee, or someplace, had tried the Stella Adler method on half the fourth grade teachers in Kingsport, or somewhere, and left the other half as a control group, and found significant improvement in reading scores among the students in the emoted-upon sample. Very goofy. And winning.
And I'd made it through.
It was clear that something had just transpired, and I was now part of it, a co-conspirator. I wasn't sure yet that these were people to be trusted, but they were up to something fascinating. Their canvas was larger than the tiny brushwork I'd learned in the house. They had a sense of inevitability about them, a sense of entitlement. They didn't flaunt it. It was almost casual. Indeed, they were less vain than most politicians. They didn't require any of the usual empty ceremonies of deference and pomposity. They didn't need the reassurance.
Their calm, absolutely certain sense of destiny represented a level of audacity well beyond the imaginings of the bulked-up, student body presidents cluttering the Congress. Their ambition was for something beyond public office. It was too breathtaking to be discussed openly. The scope of the project was simply assumed. It was colossal. I found it nervous-making, over the top, and exhilarating. I had grown up in a politics of logic, compromise, and detail. I was ready for a ride.
And so we arrived at a condominium complex on the outskirts of Manchester, one of those nondescript pre-postmodern erections, the residential equivalent of a convenience store. It was now about 4 a.m. There were pre-dawn stirrings, early workers starting their cars.
This is it? Stanton asked, clearly displeased. Tell me again, why not a hotel?
Money, convenience, said Mitch, the driver. You can keep clothes here. We can store stuff. We have some privacy.
I don't give a shit about privacy, Stanton said. You can't get known in private. I'm here to get known.
He was up the stairs, inside, rousting about, a big man in a small, grim place. There was a Xerox machine in the living room. There were stacks of leaflets, bumper stickers, stick-ons.
This looks like the end of a campaign more than the beginning, he said.
Susan took my arm, nudged me toward the kitchen. Uncle Charlie brushed past with the bags. The governor was circling the TV now. He clicked it on and got snow.
What the?
He switched channels.
More snow.
Then a local station. A rerun of Car 54, Where Are You? Then more snow.
Mitch, God damn it, Mitch! No cable? You gotta be kidding, man. You can't run for president of the United fucking States without CNN. Mitch, what was in your head? I'm out of here. This is the worst two-bit candy-ass goddamn... Hey!
Mrs. Stanton had, in one swift, fluid motion, reached into her bag, pulled out a set of keys, and whipped them, hard, at her husband's head.
Darling, she said, it's 4 a.m. This is not how you want to be introduced to the neighbors.
His reaction was curious. He wasn't angry.
Yeah, well, we're out of here tomorrow, he said, rubbing his cheek. This place smells like we lost.
I felt faint, woolly-edged, buzzy. It was just nuts. But I was there, deep into this thing already, totally sucked in. And she was moving me, pushing me gently, both hands on my back, through the swinging door, into the kitchen. Tea? She asked. The kitchen was white, fluorescent. She pulled two mugs. They were white, too. Then, abruptly, you up for this?
For what?
Take care of him. There was no way I could answer that question. But finally, a job description. We're gonna win, you know. I could have asked, how do you know? It would have been an interesting thing to hear. I wonder about it now, what she would have said. But I was already, by mutual assumption, sort of on staff, and so I merely grunted, uh-huh. She opened a cupboard. It was spiritually bare. Instant coffee, a box of white rose tea bags, Fig Newtons. No one lived there. You take anything? She asked. Honey? She opened the fridge. It was bottom heavy. An almost empty top few shelves. A jar of honey, a pint of milk. Down below, maybe 50 Cokes and Diet Cokes. A few stray six-packs of V8, ginger ale. The depressing sterility of it made Stanton's Peak almost visionary. This was a place to work, not sleep. Susan Stanton didn't seem to notice. She snagged the honey, poured the tea, and sat down across from me. She kicked off her shoes, low-heeled pumps, and then, once again, abruptly, "So why did you quit Larkin?" There was no way to fudge this, not with her. But there were layers of reasons.
It wasn't him, I said.
He's good. Good instincts, usually right, I think, she said. But too cool, maybe. Does he ever blink? I mean, literally? She was laughing. It was a nice, deep chuckle. I've never seen him blink. He's got that steady gaze.
Like a rock.
Like a lizard, she whooped.
Yeah, I agreed.
After a while, it was all the same. He taught me a lot, but he never surprised me, not much inspiration there, and it got old, roping the strays. Without hope of winning. No, it was worse. We always won. It was winning and then not winning. We'd win, and, you know, it was always 100 tiny deals, things we'd give, and I was always looking for that one vote. The guy who wasn't one of the professional heroes, you know, the smug brothers, the ones who get elected, always from elite districts because they're courageous. But I was always hoping that one of the sheep would step up and do it for history, without asking for a Lulu. Lulu? New York for artificial sweetener, I said. And sometimes you'd get one or two. Someone would wake up feeling honorable or guilty. Most of the time, there was no percentage in it for them. Why ask for trouble? It was all pretty predictable in any case. We'd win. Then we'd be gutted by the Senate. We'd settle for their version. You know, I got to see Donnie O'Brien with his palms raised more times than I'd ever need to. I could read his palms by the time it was over. We'd walk through the rotunda to his office, past all the tourists, lit up with history, and I'd always be thinking about the chasm between politics and history. But Lark would just be out there, making himself available to the civilians, his cybernetic, good-to-see-you maneuvers. Susan laughed.
Yeah, I've seen him do that, she said. It's like Stanton's mom, working the slot machines in Vegas. Automatic. Once you see something like that, it's tough to get past it. You know what? First time I saw Larkin doing that, governor's conference or something, I had this wicked feeling, she was giggling now, that he made a conscious decision to emphasize the you rather than the C because he wanted to seem, what, natural? She slapped herself on the forehead. God, poor guy. Not so poor, I said. He is the majority leader. But he wants more, and he'll never understand why he won't get there, she said. Tell me if I'm wrong, but I'd guess Donnie O'Brien is the exact opposite. Surprised he got as far as he did. Black Irish to the Senate, and then leader, geez. Had to be just thrilled to be there, right? Sweet man, I agreed, and clever. We'd go to the office, and he'd offer the Lark a harp. Lark would ask for mineral water. He wouldn't want to say Perrier in front of Donnie. And, of course, Donnie would use that. The tip-off was, we must have gone there a dozen times over the course of a few years, and Donnie always offered the harp, just to start him off on the defensive. And you guys never took the beer to see if he'd get a better deal? Susan asked. Amazing, I said. I always wondered about that. He didn't even have to go for a beer. Right, she was giddy. He could have really rocked Donnie's world, asked for a Diet Coke, a 7-Up, a club sandwich. It was late, but I hadn't expected the irreverence, the humor, the love of the game. She was breathtaking. So what then? How did Donnie let him down? He'd go up with the palms. Lark, this is what we've got, this is what we can do. I owe you one, buddy. What can I say? I stopped. I hadn't quite caught the fullness of Donnie's Irish grease. He cast a spell, as all the good ones do. In the end, it didn't mean anything anyway. We'd take it back to our side, renegotiate the Lulu, pass the damn thing, and then, as we knew from the start, the White House would veto, and we'd celebrate our great moral victory. We forced a veto. That was something, she said. Not enough. It was even worse on the stuff that had to pass, the budget. So you dropped out, she said. You gonna drop out on us? Very smooth. She was closing the deal. Okay. Have I dropped in yet? Say you have. Well, I was always curious about how it'd be, I began. How the whole process, yeah, I guess the country, too, would work with someone who actually cared about, well, you know, I wondered, it couldn't always have been the way it is now, the feeling of blah, swamp gas, stagnation. There had to be times when it was better. The other guys had it with Reagan, I guess, but to me, he was just floating with the flow. He didn't try for anything hard, and a good thing, too. She said. Yeah, I guess. The thing is, I'd kind of like to know how it feels when you're fighting over, you know, historic stuff. I'm not like you. I didn't have Kennedy. I got him from books, from TV. But I can't get enough of him, you know? Can't stop looking at pictures of him, listening to him speak. I've never heard a president use words like destiny or sacrifice, and it wasn't bullshit. So I want to be part of something, a movement like that. When it's real, when it's history, I had let things slip a little bit. That wasn't good. I was interviewing for a job where my primary responsibility would be not to let things slip. God damn, I said. My, 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 I said. Just like my father, and just like his father, the Reverend Harvey Burton, the man Susan Stanton had praised. Embarrassing. To make this into Black History Month. Unprofessional. But I saw she was with me. It was okay. Still, I had to button it up. I feel like a real jerk, even saying that sort of thing, I said. Maybe we're not living in a time when those kinds of dreams are possible, or even appropriate. But it's late, and you asked, and there it is.
No, you're right, she said. It's good. History's what we're about, too. What else is there?
Then, sleepy? She led me into the living room. There was a pillow and a blanket folded on the couch. Your quarters, she said, patting me on the back, squeezing my arm, drifting off toward the bedroom. I tossed the blanket, lay back on the pillow. It was light now. There were birds and a piney breeze through the screens. Summer camp. Uncle Charlie came padding through, wiry taut in a sleeveless t-shirt and boxers, and tattoos. Mama, with a heart on one arm. On the other, a sly devil with a pencil-thin mustache, like his, and the words, "Made me do it."
Hey, he said, "coffee?"